As you're on the podcast where we talk trash about the things people love to hate and hate to love, and we're your hosts, Shelby and Matt.
Now I do declare, Shelby, someone has been murdered in this church.
Hey, that was pretty good.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're working on it?
No, my accents are always top notch. I don't need to work on them. They're always great.
Right.
Listeners can go back to previous episodes. My accent work flawless, always.
Benoit Blanc.
This is another one of those fun episodes where, when did I watch this movie? September. And
oh
yet here
God,
we are recording.
Matt.
So I was frantically reading the Wikipedia page this, trying to reconjure in my mind what happens in this whodunit.
Yeah. This is Wake Up Dead Man, A Knives Out Mystery.
Yes.
Is that the working
yes,
title?
I believe that is the title. Although I think that they've sort of like scrapped the Knives Out part a bit, and now it's like just Wake Up Dead Man.
Wake Up Dead Man. What do you think of that title? Is that a word salad title for you?
It is a bit.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's slightly more interesting, but I kept calling it Dead Man Wake Up.
I guess it's a U2 song.
Oh,
I guess every Knives Out movie is actually a song title.
Glass Onion is a song title?
Yeah, I think it's the Beatles.
Let me look this up. Interesting. And what's Knives Out?
I don't know.
I'm like, Glass Onion song. Oh, yes, it is by the Beatles. Okay, Knives Out song is by Radiohead.
Look at that.
Are these Wake songs up. In the movie? Like,
no,
is
no.
Wake Up Dead
it's
Man
like,
in the movie
he
or no?
He says, like, they kind of inform his writing, like it's kind of the theme, like it carries similar themes, I guess. I don't know. I haven't really listened to them.
Do you think
I
the
saw
next
that
one will
passing.
Be called Oops, I Did It Again?
Yeah, I think it will be called The Life of a Showgirl.
No. The Fate of Ophelia.
Yeah, The Fate of Ophelia, A Knives Out Mystery.
I would sort of love that if it was about a like Shakespearean theater troupe and the person who plays Ophelia gets killed mid-production and it's like
that'd
her body's
great.
On stage.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's lots of room, lots of places to go. But this is a U2 song that he said he, because he had big intentions with this movie. I mean, Rian Johnson, you know, he created this character, had huge success with Knives Out, and then continued to have fun with his Southern gentleman detective in Glass Onion. But this is a little bit different. I mean, he doesn't show up for the first hour of the film, and it's like a meditation on faith versus, I don't know, cynicism. Religion versus non-religion, belief
versus
non-belief.
Someone could say, the man in black versus the man in white.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The red devil versus the white angel. But Rian Johnson, I guess, grew up really religious and has since, you know,
God
lost his faith, chosen a different path, no longer believes. And so this was a film that was really more about that conversation with himself, where he's like parsing out like what he still carries or what he finds difficult. And so it's sort of like the two sides of his life represented in Josh O'Connor as Hot Priest Take Two,
yes,
and Benoit Blanc as the more jaded realist.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also, I think, is a movie that, like, feels very current in its politics, because the character who dies, played by Josh Brolin, is, like, this very sort of angry, vengeful, bigoted priest who's, you know, gets up into the pulpit every week and, you know, sort of is spouting Trump-esque dialogue.
Yeah.
my gosh, I spoke the name of Trump and I was struck down. The devil. Oh my gosh. God said, no, don't speak ill of him. Yeah. He is my servant. So it felt very, I guess they've all sort of felt message driven to a certain extent, you know, like about wealth more so, but this feels political in a different way. The first one was kind of like an eat the rich thing, and the second one was sort of like an Elon Musk-esque,
it's like a tongue-in-cheek kind of, what is celebrity, like poking fun.
Yeah, this was definitely more, geared meditative, towards this religious, political aspect. I guess, what are your thoughts sort of on the Knives Out films? Rian Johnson, I think this is the last one in the deal that he had with Netflix. Mm. But I think that, you know, he said that he would make more... On November 18th, 2025, it was announced that Rian Johnson and Daniel Craig were starting to formulate ideas for a potential fourth Knives Out movie. So it's like, this is a franchise that appears to be doing well. I mean, it's on Netflix, so it's hard to gauge like exactly what the numbers are, but that people like, that people watch. What are your sort of thoughts about the franchise and then how this movie did, and like, do we need more, sort of where does the franchise stand coming out of this?
Yeah, I mean, I really loved the first one. It was a lot of fun, very clever. And then the second one, I also feel like I enjoyed watching, even though I could sense its weaknesses, you know, like it's definitely not as strong or like as like, you know, neatly tied up. Like it felt a little more sprawling and goofy in some ways. Even just down to the set design of this big house with the big car and a glass dome and all of that. But it's kind of intentionally goofy because Benoit Blanc doesn't understand why he's there at first, or so he presents, and it's kind of like a misdirect, and he's just like, whoa, what's going on here? So he's off duty, I guess, is the main point. I was more surprised that I had heard nothing about this third one, like, until last month. I did not know it was... I'm sure I had heard the news of the casting, like, whenever that dropped, like, a year ago or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I really didn't remember it, and I didn't know it was officially coming out until it started showing up in theaters. Kind of dialing back into it, I was like, well, you know, we've done this ride. This is the third one. Like, murder mysteries aren't always my favorite genre. I feel like they're kind of, by the sheer numbers of it, just all of them can kind of feel cliche at this point because they're all just bastardizing each other and kind of like, I don't know, how many different iterations of whodunit can you really come up with? And so I was like, I wouldn't have said I was excited. I wasn't like, oh my God, I can't wait to see it. But I feel like I was like, it wasn't like the franchise had burned me out, you know, like it was like, okay, let's see it. Hopefully it'll be fun. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think I was like, I'm a casual fan. I really don't, I don't know. I mean, what else has Rian Johnson done? I feel like there's other things, but I can't remember.
Well, that one Star Wars movie that everybody hated.
Oh my God. That's right.
Start with The Last Jedi. He also did, he's been doing that show Poker Face for Peacock, although that got canceled, I believe. And then he made Looper.
Wow, really heavy hitting stuff. Love it all. Impressive. So I will say, like, as soon as I started this one, I was like, okay, this cast isn't really doing it for me. It's not giving me Toni Collette or Kate Hudson or some, like, I don't know, some distinctive like character. Like a lot of these characters felt kind of like, okay, it's very, I mean, because of the situation, it's very white and it all skews very like conservative, religious, and you know I don't fuck with that. So I was kind of like, oh man, I do not enjoy any of these people, and they're driving me nuts, and they're so boring. But I will say, Josh O'Connor, he really stepped up. He carried that film, and that's hard to do when you're under the shadow of not only like Daniel Craig's star power, but Benoit Blanc's, like, you know, oozing charisma and any chance he gets in one of his well-tailored suits, with that accent you so perfectly nailed. So Josh O'Connor really was the thing that kept me engaged in this 2.5 hour film.
Yeah, I have liked the Knives Out movies. They're not like my favorite things in the world, but I do think that they're fun and I like that they're there. I think that the first two movies, the first one in particular, had a lot of like zany cast members, which I like. And the second one, I think maybe a slightly less so, but the fact that you had Kate Hudson, you had Catherine Hahn, like there was some fun bits of that. And Edward Norton as like the Elon Musk character, I thought was good. This for me, I enjoyed watching it. I liked the mystery of it all. I did think Josh O'Connor was good, but I think because of the subject matter being like sort of more serious, the cast members weren't as like fun.
Kooky. Yeah.
Right. Like, I guess Glenn Close is sort of the one exception, but everybody else just kind of seems like angry and miserable.
Correct.
Like Kaylee Spaney in her wheelchair and Andrew Scott and Jeremy Renner and Kerry Washington. Like, none of them are really bringing anything that's as fun to watch. So I'm kind of hopeful that whenever this fourth one comes out, we sort of move back into the territory of like of something that's a little more jazzy, that's like less church based and is more like, let's put this in show business, or like, I don't know.
I think this is better than the second. Like, I think this is a better film.
I think I like the second one just because I understand that as like sort of a mystery and as a movie, it is kind of wonky, but I think there's stronger pieces of that have stuck with me more. Like the part about the, oh, I want my name associated with the Mona Lisa. And then like that joke payoff at the end, I still think about Kate Hudson, like every single line of hers is great. And I did like Janelle Monáe in these sort of like weird twin role thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. This just was less fun. Like, I did enjoy watching it, but it was less interesting.
Right. It's a different film. Like, I would say.
But I was thinking about this because I feel like the casting for this came out around the same time as the casting for the third season of The White Lotus. And people sort of like compare the two in some ways. And it does feel like both of them have sort of fallen off a bit in the cultural zeitgeist. Like, obviously everybody watched the third season of White Lotus, but it didn't get like the Emmy wins. It just didn't feel like as zeitgeisty, and a lot of it felt like, okay, we've sort of seen this before. And I feel like the same thing with this. Like, I'm sure it will do great numbers on Netflix, or already has, but it hasn't really been getting the awards traction. And I sort of feel like heading into a fourth one, it's less of like you have to watch this, everybody's talking about it, and more of, oh, like, I like Knives Out, like, let's throw on the new one of that.
This has like 97% on Rotten Tomatoes for both audience and critic score.
Yeah, I mean, I think people, like, it's not a movie that you dislike. I just think it feels less, like,
zeitgeisty. You don't think it'll get, like, a best original screenplay nomination?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe. I guess it's possible. But I feel like when the first one came out, everyone was talking about that year.
Correct. Yeah.
And then when the second one came out, there was so much hype around it because everyone loved the first one so much.
But then it didn't do that well critically, right? Or awardedly.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't do as well as the first one, obviously. And then
I think this stands a chance of reclaiming some of that, at least like respect, you know. Like, I don't know if it's as memorable, but I think there's an argument to say this is a stronger script.
It's definitely
and
a stronger mystery because it's like tighter in that it's the sort of, what is it, like the closed room mystery. And so it's like, okay, there's only these characters, and how does this person die when, like, seemingly nobody is touching him? The other thing about this that I was sort of a little bit annoyed by is I feel like some of these actors are a little bit wasted. Like, I love Andrew Scott, and I wish, I'm like, why did you waste him here?
He built
this moat. This is sort of like a nothing role for him. And I wish that they had saved him for another Knives Out movie when he could have done something more exciting. I was like, ah, like, damn it.
Yeah. Well, this is more like gothic. So it is very like droll and dark and moody and somber.
Yes.
And it was interesting to see these characters. Like, I think that is part of like the paradigm shift. You're like, oh, no one's like having fun in the same way. And that's like, you just have to accept that for the story as it is. And that's why I think it was clever to not bring in Benoit Blanc until later, because it allowed you to kind of forget that this is part of that. And so it like added some distance from the kookier earlier films, and it kind of became Josh O'Connor's piece. I was like, I've honestly, I didn't necessarily enjoy the first half. And I think part of that just comes from my own religious background. And it's just like a really hard thing for me to bridge of like accepting organized religion as anything positive, because I just have only ever noticed the like negative. And so like when you're trying to get me to be on the side of the Catholic Church, it's like, it's asking a lot of me. It's asking a lot of me to like take Josh O'Connor's pitch seriously, because sure, he's a good guy and he has a good idea, but like, to me, the institution is so corrupt, as proven by this priest they can't get rid of or like course correct, even though he's spouting like horrific violence every week, and we're just like playing nice with it. But it's like, but then that also engaged me through the second half of the film, of this question of like, well, maybe it's less about like, maybe it is storytelling, but does that story resonate in a way that motivates you to be better? Which is like an easy argument for organized religion, and I've heard it many times, but I think having this sort of like duel of thought between Benoit Blanc and Father Judd was helpful. What's to Judd? Kind of is that his name?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. It was like, it became more interesting. I know, with a sexy neck tattoo peeking out of his collar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
maybe Hot Priest was only in this to pass the torch to the next Hot Priest, you know?
The next Hot Priest. Yeah. Yes. That's, you know, but it's, I sort of wanted casting a Hot Priest off, you know, and it didn't get that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the question with religion is such a fascinating one, and obviously something that I think about a lot too, as someone who grew up in a very organized religion. And I think that it's hard because so much of what the actual, like, like a crux of, of a religion, like the deep, like the central part of it, is so positive.
Yeah.
And there are so many people who have used religion to very positive effects throughout history. But then the organized sort of structure around that has really gotten so bad that it's almost a completely separate thing from the original crux of what like Christianity in particular was supposed to be. But because the organized aspect of it, like, it is so large and so ubiquitous, it's kind of eclipsed and like whatever the original germ of the idea was. And so I do always think it's interesting when movies, books, whatever, deal with this sort of grappling of, okay, like, I grew up in a faith and I believe it, but also I'm sort of stuck in this group with all these people who are executing that faith in a completely different way, to the point where I don't even know if they are Christian really, even though they're the larger majority of it. So I don't know, like, I think that is a worthwhile thing to grapple with, and is important to have stories about, because I do think that there are lots of people who go to churches across America and are like, wait, I'm reading in the Bible that Jesus says we're supposed to love everybody. And, you know, I want to help people and I care about people. But then also I turn on the news and I see them say like, oh, well, as a Christian, we're supposed to like hate trans people, or we need to get, you know, immigrants out of the country. And how do those things line up? And I think for people like you and I, like, we've spent our entire lives like examining that process and trying to like deconstruct it and figure out, where do we stand in relation to all of these things? Are we not religious at all? Are we like religious in part? Like, you know, we've spent a lot of time thinking about this.
Yeah.
I think most people have not spent very much time, if any time at all, thinking about it. So when these ideas pop up in mainstream media, I'm like, okay, well, this is like a positive, because I think there are going to be a lot of people who are, you know, quote unquote Christians, who watch this movie on Netflix, and maybe it, you know, urges some of them to think about some things. But yeah, it is kind of ooh, let me turn on this fun little movie and watch a murder mystery. It's kind of like, oh, wait, we're going into, oh, okay. We're gonna do a deep dive into organized religion. And especially something like the Catholic Church, which is thousands of years old and has all kinds of negative and positive things, you know, interwoven. It's like, oh, well, there's the Crusades, but there's also Mother Teresa. Like, there's monks creating champagne. There's nuns, like, locking people up who've had abortions. You know, it's like, there's all kinds of things going on within the Catholic faith. And, like, can you reclaim that? Or do we just, like, chop that off and sort of start again? I don't know.
It was like... Like, I think, I don't know, like, I it was an interesting film for me, because it was kind of like, I was very defensive and like, ugh, I just don't like it. I can't stand for this. I hate this whole concept. But it was like, you also do side with Father Judd when he's like, we just need to like love, like we should be in the personal. We should be curious and open-minded and hearing people and giving space for people to feel heard. And like, that is the most simple, basic, like human instinct we should all be cultivating way more than we do. And so him as a character, regardless of his like his chosen organization, he's very compelling. And like, I really enjoyed watching him perform through this, of like getting swept up in the drama of it, and the need to like prove a point, prove his own innocence, but then realizing like, wait, is this even like productive for me anymore? Like, am I doing any good if I'm casting myself as me against them? Like, you know, just this question of like, yeah, kind of like, how do you exist in a world where the instinct is to put your guards up and make a fight of it and have a us versus them mentality and all of that. I do feel like the movie, maybe like the ensemble, did slow down the movie somehow. Like, I don't think they were that compelling, or like, and not only that, they weren't like fun, you know, they weren't having fun, but they just like didn't, they felt like tropes in a lot of ways, and they weren't like fully fleshed characters. Like, it's like, okay, so there's this doctor and his wife left him, and so now he's mad. And it's like, okay, well, that's a very specific trope of like the guy who gets far right because he feels like women don't respect him or whatever, and he's like mad at the world. And then you have this political wannabe who's like, I tried all the right language to like get people behind me of all this like hate and racist rhetoric, and it just didn't work. So that's a bummer. But it just like all of them felt like weirdly thinly drawn, and like, and so it was kind of like weird to have such fully like fleshed out characters with Father Judd and Benoit Blanc and their beliefs and their complexities, but then have these side characters who all were like uninteresting. Like, the fact that the church congregation was just these five nutcases. And like, it felt like a stage play. Like, it felt like less real life.
I mean, the fact that it's like, okay, it's this church, but really there's only like five members, I did think was a bit odd. Like, because they needed it, the killing to happen at a church service.
Yeah.
So they needed to have a limited amount of people there. But I kind of wish that, you know, it had been like an actual church and that he had been murdered, you know, like in some prayer group or something, maybe that was separate from that. Because it did kind of feel odd, like, okay, wait, he has this church, but there's only like five people who are at the Good Friday service. Like, that's
insane. And like, why did he only want, like, it was like his intention to drive people away, but then he was like, he didn't make sense as a character to me, like the racist priest to be like, well, I don't want them in my congregation, but then he's yelling about losing ground and stuff, and it's like, well, you literally have lost all your congregants.
I also think that just for like a setup of a group of characters, that like all of these people go to church together is kind of, I don't know, like there's not that much baked into that initially. Yeah. And you don't know what their relationships with each other are. So there's a lot of groundwork that you have to lay of like, who are these characters and why are they connected to each other? What are their interactions with one another? And then also I think this cast is just bigger, where like with Glass Onion or with Knives Out, I guess it's so straightforward because it's a family. So there's already so many different dynamics that are just like cooked into that based on what we know as a family. And oh, all of these people are like trying to get money off of their, you know, dead grandfather.
Well, and like, so much of that movie is like interviews with them, so you get a lot of like insight into them just by the conversation of it all, whereas here they're really just like in the background for most of it.
Well, and they all sort of have the same backstory of Knives Out, where like, oh, they're all relatives of a rich person. So yes, they have different personality types, but you don't really have to get into that much other detail. And I feel like with Glass Onion, because it's like a COVID situation, one, there's less people, but then they're all, you know, sort of like colleagues, friends whatever, of this really rich person. So you also can see what the dynamics of that would be right away. And it's also just like a smaller cast, where with this, the cast is bigger and everybody is sort of like starting from scratch. And I didn't think that the characters were like that sort of fun that you immediately got the sense of who they were, because most of the vibes of the cast were just kind of like, oh, these angry, depressed people. It wasn't, there wasn't a lot of nuance where it's like, oh, and this is the ditzy girlfriend and oh, this is the like over the top actress and whatever, you know?
Yeah. Well, so, even like the characters we do have, it's like Kerry Washington. I was like, what do you mean you have to be like devoted to this church because your dad was like, and you adopted this guy and you're like the lawyer, but you also have to attend the church. I'm like, I don't think that needed to be, I don't, like, it didn't make sense why these people were so invested in father, whatever. Well,
they also weren't churchy people.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Glenn Close's. Like Glenn Close's character, I think worked because it's like, oh yeah, if you've been to church, you know that there's some like old gossipy woman who's been there for forever and is like so enmeshed in like the church politics of it all and has all these opinions on things, like, and the fact that her husband's kind of like the doofy groundskeeper, like that made sense to me. The rest of the people who are at the church, it was like, these are not standard church archetypes. Like, if you wanted a politician, it should be like a very schmoozy politician with his wife and like six blonde daughters. And he's like, you know, having an affair on the side, because I feel like that is somebody who goes to church. Or like somebody who's like a very Midwestern mom who's like dragging their like goth emo son who doesn't want to be there. Like, those are more church. Yeah. Or like someone who's like very missionary-y and like evangelism focused. But these felt like people who wouldn't be going to church, but then somehow had to be shoehorned into as to why they were going.
Yeah, like the writer.
Why is this novelist going to church every Sunday with this horrible man?
And losing his creativity. I don't know. It was just like, okay. Yeah, they all just kind of felt like...
And then Mila Kunis as the sheriff was so boring. I was like, for someone who is a funny actress who like has the capacity to do comedy, she was doing nothing. Like, that could have been anybody in that role. Like, I could have done that role and been just stood there and delivered the lines.
Well, that's interesting. Do you think this was meant to be a comedy? Because it just felt darker than the other ones, like more of like a gothic horror.
In some ways, yes, but in some ways, no. Like, because the first two movies are comedies to a large extent, I think that you think that this is going to be funny. And I do feel like some of the, you know, like some of Benoit Blanc's stuff, some of Glenn Close's stuff, like, is funny. And even Josh Brolin is so over the top and exaggerated that I think there is supposed to be a level of like farce to this.
Yeah.
But it's not. Yeah. I think just because it's darker, it doesn't really like work in the same way. And so a character like the sheriff, who like maybe could be funnier in another version of this movie, because the movie's so serious, I feel like that character, it doesn't really know what to do, and there's not like a natural funny beat for it to hit, so it ends up just being this very straightforward, boring sheriff woman. And it's like, well, why are you using Mila Kunis for this? Like, you could have just hired, like, you know, some random off the street if you needed somebody to like deliver.
Maybe she wanted to cut her teeth on a more serious role, Matt. Maybe she wanted to play it straight for once.
Well, didn't she play a very serious role in that movie we covered for the podcast where she was like a girlfriend who got like killed or something? Yeah. What was that movie?
Still Alice or something.
No, Still Alice is the movie about the woman as is Julianne Moore when, like, she has her mom. Luckiest Girl Alive?
Luckiest Girl Alive, yeah. She like survived a school shooting or something.
She was a New York Magazine editor with a picture perfect life. She's marrying a fiance. I'm like, I don't remember.
This is school shooting.
This movie. There was a school shooting? That's what it was?
Yeah, it was like, there's a school shooting, or like her boyfriend.
I do not remember her that boyfriend at all.
Like killed people or like stabbed classmates or something.
Stabbed classmates.
I swear, it's very serious, Matt.
Her boyfriend like shot people or like stabbed classmates or something.
I mean,
stabbing classmates in the year of our 2020.
Unfortunately, it's very relevant. Yes, yeah. Probably. Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dial that back, sir.
I guess they weren't classmates, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So I feel like I want to talk about sort of the mystery itself.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so basically,
no spoilers for everybody.
Yeah, spoiler alert. So basically, yeah, Josh Brolin gets stabbed, and then through the course of the film, supposedly resurrects, and then dies in a vat of acid that the doctor has for some reason.
Yes,
pretty creepy. Cuckoo bananas. But so then it turns out it was Glenn Close all along, who did it because she wanted to save the congregation of five people, keep the belief going, and remove the temptation of this diamond that has been passed down. I don't know. So it got convoluted for me personally.
It got convoluted very quickly. As I was reading the summary, I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Oh, yes. And then there was this part.
It was pretty dope how in the original, like, they tell the story of Josh Brolin's dad, who also later in life became a priest. And he had this wayward daughter who had a child out of wedlock who was Josh Brolin. And so he's like, you can live with us and then let me raise your son. And once I'm dead, you can have my fortune that I had before I became a priest. And I actually really thought they did a good job with this woman, this like random extra playing this, like, what do they call her? Harlot whore.
Yes, the harlot whore.
Harlot whore. And there's a scene where she tackles a young Glenn Close, and that physicality was so stunning to me, the way she goes after this child. I was like, wow, give her an Oscar just for that. Like, I love the attack, the ferocity with which she tackles this 8-year-old. Really unsettling and violent and powerful. But so it turns out that she's mad because there is no money. But then through the course of the film, you realize that the elder priest had bought a diamond with all his fortune. called it Eve's apple and then choked on it and died so that it would die with him. It would be buried with him in his chest. And so life goes on, and only Glenn Close knows this fact. But then she confesses it to Josh Brolin. And that's when Josh Brolin decides to like kind of leave the church and live a life of wealth and luxury that he's always wanted. Which is interesting, whatever. I could have done without this, like, I mean, I know they needed it to give every character motivation, but like the whole confession scene, like where he's like, I'm going to drag y'all to hell. I don't know. Like, that's where I got lost, because again, the side characters didn't make sense. And so Cy, the racist podcaster or YouTuber, is actually Josh Brolin's son, correct?
Yes.
And so, and we find this out because Kerry Washington's character discovered it kind of randomly, happenstance. And she'd always thought he was her father's son. Yeah, I'm just imagining people who haven't watched this movie trying to listen to this.
It is so convoluted, because I was also spent the whole movie trying to figure out who the daughter was, because who the harlot whore was, because I was like, oh, well, that's got to be somebody in cast. No. So I was like, somebody's got to be the harlot whore. Nope.
No, she's just a sad woman. Yeah,
there was a lot of like flashbacks and connections to things.
Yeah.
Because basically the plot, like, Glenn Close is like, okay,
she's devout. She's the only devout person.
And she's like, I have to keep this gem out of the hands of these other people, but the gem is in the dead corpse of the grandfather that is in this tomb. And so there's kind of like we got to get somebody in the tomb so they can get the stone out of the dead body, and so that's why there's these various like fake death scenarios going on, because, you know, if they die then they can get put in a thing, but then they're not actually dead, so then they'll wake up, but they'll have the gem. There's a lot of different plot points. Like, I think the actual construction of Josh O'Connor's murder in the church is interesting, poisoned, and then they taped the thing so it looked like he was stabbed, but he actually hadn't been stabbed yet. He was stabbed later. Like, I thought that that was interesting. The whole then saga regarding like the different backstories and Diamond and whatever was a bit confusing, and I wish that it had just been a little bit more streamlined.
Well, because my main question came around to Jeremy Renner. Why was he involved? Except she needed help, but what was his motivation in being involved? Because at first he was like, yeah, I'll do it, and not for any money. He just was going to do it because he was a believer, or because he wanted to stop Josh Brolin's character from outing him as a drunk doctor. He's going to help this old lady and literally stab a man, like poison a man and then stab him.
Right.
But then he was on board with also playing along with this resurrection. And he wasn't intending to kill Glenn Close's lover, but then he did once he saw the diamond.
I haven't
seen it in five
years.
Yeah,
it's like I don't remember the plot well enough to be able to get into these intricacies, but I remember thinking it was complicated at the time, and reading the Wikipedia page, it's not straightforward.
And like how did he have a vat of acid? Like, I'm just confused by this. Like, I get that it's the only way to really...
Does Rob not have a vat of acid in your house as a doctor? No,
unfortunately.
That's not
like
a
it's like Glenn Close got too greedy, right? Because she wanted this resurrection to like reinvigorate people's faith, I guess, to like have a fake miracle. Yes. But it doesn't like make sense, because it just was like, girl, you needed to be less ambitious. Like, it's like you had the perfect crime, you killed him, you hid the diamond, congrats. But then it was like, no, we're going to do this. I don't know. Like, I was just like, all she had to do was like go into like say her farewell in the tomb before they lock the door if she really wanted to grab the diamond. But it's like the diamond was dying with him, you know, like no one else knew it except her, and she'd already confessed it and did her five Hail Marys, so she was, you know, forgiven.
The question I was asking the whole thing is like, how does one even swallow a diamond? Like, I know that some people are better at swallowing pills than others, but I'm like swallowing a like razor sharp diamond down your throat.
Well, he didn't survive.
Well, I mean, I know that, but I'm like, I don't even know how. Like I couldn't even get the swallowing part done.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Some like, people have different talents, you know.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, you know, like they can just open their throat and and the diamond falls right down in the back. No, you know what? I don't need to be throwing gemstones anytime soon. Like, no, thank you.
I mean, people will like swallow bags of drugs, you know.
Yeah, but I feel like a bag of drug is like squishier. You know,
I see. You're just like, yeah.
Also, do people swallow those? I think you just shove them up your butt.
Both have happened according to various TV shows I've watched. You know?
I feel like if you swallow it, wouldn't it dissolve in the stomach acid and then you die?
Well, yeah, it's part of it. I mean, Charlie in Lost swallows his bag of heroin, you know, chokes on it.
Oh, does he? Oh, and then he throws it up later.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're not trying to poop it out. You're just trying to
Right. Yes. You're just trying to keep it for a second and then you'll get it back up. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. And then, yeah, the ending of the story is that Benoit looks dumb. He allows himself to look like he didn't solve it. He doesn't get his final, what does he call it? His hammer down or whatever.
Yeah.
And he decides, you know, to give grace to the actual murderer to be able to make the confession of her own accord, which I feel like is interesting for his character, who has seemed ego driven in every iteration so far. But it was sort of like, well, I mean, she did still confess and she will still go to prison. I don't know. I feel like. I don't know. I guess.
Well, because also he didn't want to reveal like that the stone was.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. And it was like her chance for penance and like her chance for the last rites or whatever it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And so then Josh O'Connor also benefited from it because he got to play priest. He got to remember. He got his closure of like not wanting it to be a game and not wanting it to be a whodunit of us versus them. And he instead got to show grace in the last act of this. Frankly, crazy woman's life. And that was nice, I guess. Nice.
Yeah.
I do feel like, I guess, yeah. What are you going to do with a big ass diamond that someone else is technically owner of? You know, he couldn't sell it. He couldn't donate it because it would have just gone to Psy and that would have been worse. So I guess it's just, yeah, I guess. Yeah, I guess there's no good.
You just solution. Put it. You just hide it in the new crucifix.
You just hide it in the crucifix. Yeah.
Because the harlot whore busted the last one.
Yeah.
harlot whore is a great, like that. That's maybe the best part of the entire movie is just every time that Glenn Close says harlot whore.
Yeah.
And she says it about 80 times in the movie, and it never gets old.
You know what else stood out to me is how short Josh Brolin is. I just like. He's always played these larger than life characters, aka.
I'm like, how tall is
he? Aka, what's his face in Avengers?
Josh Brolin. Oh, Thanos. Josh Brolin is 5'10.
Well, so he looked like so height. Short. How tall is Josh O'Connor?
Okay. Oh, I think he's taller. Let's
he's
see.
Like 6'10.
Josh O'Connor height. He is 6'1".
Yeah, well, Josh Brolin was looking small in this movie, okay? There's like a picture of him next to Jeremy Renner. I'm like, these guys are shorty kings. Well, not kings, but...
Well, Jeremy Renner is definitely short.
I know, and Josh Brolin's right there with him, I'm saying. You know, it's just a small little man.
Jeremy Renner, I somehow Googled Jeremy Reeves, who is a football player, and I've never heard of. Jeremy Renner is 5'9".
Yeah.
But I do think that probably they're both shorter than whatever these numbers that they're telling Wikipedia are. So like, because I don't think Wikipedia is like measuring some with a ruler. You know what I mean? Like, I think that Jeremy Renner's like, yeah, I'm 5'9", and it's like, no, you're 5'7". Yeah.
I also was kind of like, I feel like this movie had a lot of green screen. Is that wrong? Did you feel that? Do you remember that? I was like,
I don't think about remember
this forest that. Feels green screeny to me.
But well, I mean, I know that they filmed somewhat at least on location because there were those photos of Josh O'Connor, it's like in the woods by this church or whatever.
Okay.
So I mean, I think maybe that it was just part
a lighting issue for me
was good. But I will say, like, all of those sequences by the tomb at night, the lighting was definitely like, there was a lot of light. There was a lot of something going on with that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was like, oh, they built that and it was just sort of random, or if that was like a set that they had, or if some of that was green screen. I'm not really sure.
I mean, and also I guess it goes to this question of like the greater good, but it's like Glenn Close was fully ready to lie about a miracle. Like, that seems pretty like anti-Christian, you know? You can't lie about a miracle.
Like, I mean,
what was her plan? She'd be lying the rest of her life. Like, doesn't the Catholic Church like send people to verify miracles? So she'd have to like tell this story to someone over and over, and that's a lie.
Yeah, you know, I don't.
Hypocrite.
She was not. I mean, as someone who was calling somebody else the harlot whore the entire time, like, I don't necessarily think that she was tracking on grade A Christian wavelength. I think there was some levels.
But the whole problem started because she finally confessed. She finally confessed to.
She was going through it.
Yeah.
She was a woman on the verge. I mean, the lying. So here's the thing that's interesting about the Bible. This is a side tangent.
Okay.
I took a class in college that.
Congrats. I took a class every semester.
Okay, great. Yes. And they were all on Frankenstein, from what I know.
No, I took this class.
No, we had to take this class in college. Well, oh, yeah. No, I took so many religious classes in college. But we had to take one that was called Speculative Mind. And it was sort of about political, like modern sort of conundrums, you know. So they'd be like, we're going to talk about gay marriage, we're going to talk about abortion, we're going to like, you know, different kinds of sort of hot button issues. And one of the readings that we had to do was this essay where a guy's like, you know, everybody in the all of the talk about Christianity and sins are like, oh, all sins are the same, all sins are bad, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he was like, actually, if you read the Bible, there's very clear delineations of like which sins are worse than other sins, because lots of times people will do one sin to sort of like negate another one. You know, it's like killing someone is wrong, but if you're killing somebody in like a holy war or whatever, then that's okay.
Yeah.
And so there's parts in the Bible where characters lie to other people to, you know, save themselves or whatever. Mm. Like when the spies come to Rahab's house, I think that's who it is, and she hides them on the roof, and then the army comes and they're like, have you seen the spies? And she's like, no, I haven't
she's
seen
like,
the spies.
What?
She's like, who are the spies, girl? Like, what? No one's here. It's just me and the hay up on the roof. And so then they leave, and then, you know, the spies go about their business. And it's like, well, she lied in that moment, but she's sort of like told to, or it, like, if she hadn't, you know.
But can you lie to a priest? You know what I mean?
So what I'm saying is that I feel like there are some places in the Bible where characters do, or people, whatever, lie in order to the greater good. So maybe she was sort of channeling that energy here.
Yeah,
but no, I do find it a bit suspect.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And yes, if you, I think, I mean, like with, you watch that movie with Florence Pugh, where she's the woman who gets sent to like investigate the miracle of the child who's supposedly not eating. Did you watch that? It was on Netflix.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
I feel like, I was going to say, I feel like I have recollections of you liking that. But it's like, Yeah, if somebody comes in our day and age and is claiming a miracle, it's like there are going to be investigative people trying to suss that out. So,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know how you would do that with him of like, okay, was he dead? We don't really have medical records on that other than from this doctor who fell into his own pit of sulfuric acid that he keeps in his house. But
yeah. Okay, fair. Yeah,
okay. Well, anything else to discuss with Knives Out 3? I'm kind of like, this, it was fine.
Yeah. I think I wouldn't be surprised if we see it pop up again.
Like, I think we'll definitely get another Knives Out movie.
No, but I mean, like, I feel like this movie might get some award contention. Oh. You know, like, I think
I'm looking at the awards it has right now. And, like, it was listed is in National Board of Review's top 10 films. The Golden Globe announcements are out, so it's not getting that. It got second place at the second runner-up, so I guess that's third place, at the Toronto Film Festival's, like, People's Choice Awards. I have to imagine this is doing well on Netflix.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's number one or whatever.
Yeah. So
yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I don't know how many original screenplays there are this year. I guess there's a lot.
Let me look. Let's go to Gold Derby. No. What else do we got going on? Goldderby.com. Oh, I can look at best original screenplay and check and see what the vibes are.
We got Sorry Baby. No, not Sorry Baby. Yeah, Sorry Baby.
Okay. Well, I actually I think that technically this is would be an adapted screenplay.
Oh. Because it's based on a...
Because I think character? If it's a sequel, I think sequels go into adapted because they're like technically based on IP from another movie. So, okay. So this is listed fifth in the adapted screenplay category behind One Battle After Another, Hamnet, Begonia, and No Other Choice. Other options in this category would be Frankenstein, Wicked for Good, The Life of Chuck, Nuremberg.
Yeah,
the course. Springsteen movie. So you know what? Honestly, this could get a best screenplay nomination.
I was right. Matt was wrong. I have a better sense of.
I think it got lucky that it's in the category that has less of the Oscar movies in it, because I think there's a lot more. There's a lot stronger competition in original screenplay.
Okay. Well, One Battle After Another is right there.
Well, yes. I mean, I don't think this movie will be winning, but I think it could get nominated. Yes. I do think that One Battle After Another will be winning a lot of Oscars and Wake Up Dead Man will be winning none. But
okay. Well, as long as it gets nominated, I'll feel proud.
As long as it gets nominated for one Oscar so that Shelby can put that on her resume. She's
2025. What a year. What a collection of movies we've watched and discussed.
Well, and we will get into those when we do our ranking episode, but that won't be until like February.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because
we gotta catch up on things.
I know. I've been keeping up mostly, I think.
Shelby's gotta watch Avatar.
Ugh, don't remind me.
3 hours, baby. Actually, I think it's 3.5.
Did you like it more or less than the second one?
I sort of liked it more.
Oh, interesting.
But I'll tell you why. There's one, the new Fire Girl is like a diva.
Yeah.
And okay. I'm like, oh, I could watch her for a million hours. Like, as she sort of like slinks around in her, the outfits in Avatar are insane because everybody is wearing like a mesh loincloth or whatever that is somehow artfully being like double stick taped to their body the entire time, even though you're like flying around and burning and explosions and whatnot. And this woman is literally wearing like one like half inch strip of leather that just covers her two nipples and connects in the back the entire time. I'm like, you cannot tell me that would not fall off at some point. But I was obsessed with her just like running around, screaming at people, like wearing this one nipple strap, like icon. So I don't know if that will resonate with you in the same way that it resonated with me, but I did love that. So I don't know. Great. I liked it more. This one's kind of wacky, I think. It feels less serious.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay, great. So, well, I look forward to that. And then also as said before, Anaconda, which I frankly don't think will be good, but I hold out hope that maybe.
Oh, I'm so excited for Anaconda.
I feel like they showed too much in the trailer. Like, they showed so much in the trailer that I'm sort of like, well, that there can't be much funnier bits left, you know, but we'll see.
I don't know. I feel like that most of the trailer looks like it's from the first half of the movie, or from like the first like quarter of the movie.
I mean, maybe.
Because don't, like, you think that
stint where like people are killed, and then they try to kill, they think Jack Black is dead, and anyways, yeah, it doesn't matter.
That's true.
It doesn't matter. I'm still looking forward to it.
I'm excited, and I'm also honestly sort of excited for The Housemaid.
So, oh yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I saw a you know, a propaganda video, I'm sure, from the studio on TikTok that was like people, like a screening of it with, that was full of people like reacting to stuff, and they were mm-hmm. like, yeah, get her, like, ah. So I'm kind of hopeful for whatever that energy was when I go and see it, of like,
did they
of
have like their fingers, I don't know. Yes.
I am jazzed.
So. Like, oh my god, that's totally real.
And I could have asked to go to screenings for these two movies, but I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna watch them. I think these would be nice holiday. Like, I need something to do for the next couple of weeks. Cute. And so I'm like, yes, am I gonna go see The Housemaid and Anaconda? 1,000%. 1,000%.
Amazing. Oh, I look forward to that experience.
Okay. Well, have a happy Christmas, Shelby.
Thank you so much.
And we will reconvene in the new year.
I look forward to it.
Okay. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back in 2026. Bye.